I'll repeat Dan's thanks to all of you for coming in, because it is a beautiful day outside. I had a nice walk over here and enjoyed some scenery in Toronto today as I got a chance to walk around. So I appreciate it, and I will try to do my best also to keep this succinct, even though what we've chosen as an organization for this global event series is a very broad topic. And so whenever somebody says enterprise risk management, it's usually going to be something that people say, I don't want to hear, because I've heard all that before. It's just too high level, and I'm not going to get anything interesting out of it. Or it's out of their space. And I hope that even though there will be some very high level things that I talk about here tonight, there are a couple of things that have caught my attention in these last 6-7 months, now that I've had a little bit of freedom to do some research and do some reading since handing over the reins at Premia, that I hope you too will find of interest. And I hope we'll stir some interest in your part in reading some new areas and challenge some of your thinking. Diane and I were just chatting a second ago about a journal issue that's coming out. And I'll offer this out to anyone in the room who's interested in submitting a paper for this journal. Premia's journal is called the Journal of Risk Management in Financial Institutions. And I was asked to be a special editor for an issue later this year. And we've called the issue the blind spots of risk management. Now, this is not something that's related to the subprime crisis, although I am sure there are going to be some papers submitted that involve things from the subprime crisis, lessons learned. Really, it's a chance for us as a profession to step back and ask questions about what we do. Have we taken the right approach to things? Are there things we're missing? Are we too focused on what we do, particularly in financial risk management, so that we're missing things from psychology, non-financial risk management? Something I'll mention tonight in terms of a new area of research, a relatively new area of research, which I think has the potential to change everything we've thought about in risk management. That's what I hope will get your attention. And that's towards the end, so if you don't mind staying around until the attention getter, that will be great. But I hope if you'll consider the submission deadline is May 8th, so you have just about a month. If you have a paper in you that can look at something we're doing in risk management in a critical way or a way that might challenge the way people think, by all means, send something in. Happy to have the submissions. Okay, very basic stuff. In terms of what we do in risk management, I'm going to touch on that in a second. But the foundations of firm value, without trying to get too deep into finance theory and getting myself in trouble, anything, any financial asset is typically a discounted measure of future states of the world, or the future states of value of that asset, whether it's a probabilistic assessment or some sort of defined series of cash flows. Discounting that back to today gets us to a price that we all agree on is some sort of fair value for an asset. Pardon that reference to fair value for anyone who's trying to value hard to value assets according to fair market value rules or mark-to-market rules. But that's the idea. We're trying to get back to something that we believe has a no arbitrage condition attached to it and reflects the value of something today. Some of the assumptions, obviously, that go behind that are the markets are efficient, that information is widely shared and symmetrical. You might not hear it expressed as being symmetrical, but that's something I think that is important in terms of getting efficiency out of the marketplace. Now, I put this question up here about challenges because since I came out of graduate school in economics and I went to work in the futures markets in Chicago, lots of things were happening in the financial markets that didn't seem to make sense in the efficient market world that I was schooled. There were trends in the markets. There was technical analysis, this voodoo that we practiced in the financial futures markets to predict where prices were going. And the conversations that I had with my colleagues who were pursuing their PhDs in economics were they couldn't believe that I actually believed things like this could work and could present us with some new information, because obviously the markets were efficient and everything was out there for full price discovery. So let's start from that point. Now, risk management, isn't this a nice slide? Risk management is, let's see if I can get this to work correctly here, it's something practiced in a couple of different places. So I'm going to do my best to try and draw something that looks like a distribution. And if this is where we are today, in terms of whatever it is that we're looking at, the value of a firm, the value of a bond, the error rate on a production process. Risk management tends to work really well in this area. So for very small changes around the current state today, I hope this makes some sense what I'm trying to describe here. And this, again, could be duration hedging, foreign exchange hedging, convexity hedging, delta hedging, whatever it might be. It might be production line management, again, error rates. And then we've spent an awful lot of time working out here, particularly in financial risk management, this being the tail end of losses. Value at risk, capital allocation, anything that's presumably a rare event, and convincing ourselves to some degree that we're able to project the probability of events happening out here. On occasion, people being convinced that they can project things to a 99.9, 99.975, 99.75% confidence. So I see in terms of most of the writing, most of the research, and most of the conversation around risk management, the focus in these two areas. There's a little bit done about how we get from here to here, but probably not enough. I mean, you might say, is that operational risk management? But it's really not. I'm thinking more in terms of the process. What is it that happens between where we are today and when we get out to some sort of a tail event? What is it that we're doing in terms of risk management that helps us to deal with that? Okay. So, enterprise risk management. Enterprise risk management has been around since the mid-1990s. Those of you who know James Lamb, he's probably the one most well known for this. James and I met probably in 1993, at a risk conference. And James was putting on a presentation on something called firmwide risk management. And that was held maybe on the third floor of the conference hall, and I think there were 10 or 12 of us in the room. So there weren't that many people talking about it back then. But this notion of a holistic view of the corporation's risks was starting to gain some attention. It was something that made a lot of sense. I mean, we have risks that are moving in different directions throughout a firm. So maybe there are things that we can put together that act as natural hedges. And maybe we can put some sort of a price on risk so that we turn risk into an income statement line item. Those of you who know Chris Mattin, who's written a book on banking risk management or bank capital, Chris said at a conference we were at one time that risk is the single biggest line item not found on an income statement. That's changed a bit since that time, but still the notion of a price for risk, charging somebody for risk, it's not as widely adopted as we might think. But again, this is one of the foundations of enterprise risk management, is that if we're going to be competing for scarce capital in the firm, we need to put some sort of a price on it. An elimination of silos, we hear, this isn't so much of a problem anymore, but whether it be market risk, credit risk, operational risk, accounting, whatever buckets that we've got different kinds of risk management in, enterprise risk management is an attempt to try and bring them together in some sort of a form. And then this last one, which I think is most important, is that it's about integrating risk management into the business process. And if there's one thing I say in every presentation I give, it's that businesses exist to take risk. Without taking risk, there's no reason to be in business, and so as risk managers, one of the things we're doing is just to try and make business better at taking risk. So by integrating it into the normal business planning process so that it's equally discussed with market share, costs, human capital, whatever it might be, that's one of the foundations of ERM. I mentioned James Lamb. James's book has been out since maybe 2001, 2002. I'm sure he's got another edition coming up. But James takes basically four steps towards enterprise risk management in his book. Foundation setting. This is the communication from the board about the corporate risk appetite. What is the board willing to do? What is the company willing to do in terms of taking risk? Risk identification and assessment. Book of risks. What are the high impact, low probability events, high impact, high probability events, whatever they might be. And that's put into some sort of a report that then you measure and you develop key risk indicators, KRIs. These are things that you're going to be watching in your dashboard, so to speak. It might be a heat map. It might be whatever the term is that's used at a company, a red, yellow, green, whatever is used to report these risks that have been identified. And then the choices of mitigation, transfer, and management. That's the approach that they would take, and again, typically referred to as a dashboard approach. Another approach to enterprise risk management is the COSO approach. Now, this is driven by the audit and accounting world. And if you read through the COSO document, you'll find that that's the mindset that's in there. This is really about putting processes in place where somebody who could come in from an audit function, either an external audit or a regulator, and say, yes, we have these things, and therefore we have risk management. So it's typically, I guess I have one of these laser pointers here. It's typically, is it working? Identified as a cube. So this cube, in somewhat complex way, covers strategic, operational, reporting, compliance across the top, entity level, division, business unit, subsidiaries across the side, and all those other things on the front. And somewhere buried deep in the middle is risk assessment of operations at the division level. You have to go kind of deep to get this. You'll find that I'm not a big fan of COSO. COSO has grabbed hold in a lot of places because it's a relatively attractive notion that I can put together a list to show my board, show my auditors, show my regulators. We have all of these things. The problem with the COSO approach as it's implemented in many places is that's where it stops. I've checked the box. I've got that. I'm not necessarily integrating it into my business process other than making it a process itself so it doesn't become part of my business decision making. One I like a little bit more is this governance, risk, and compliance approach. I don't know if any of you are familiar with OSEG, Open Compliance and Ethics Group, I think is what it stands for. A nice looking chart, and that should tell you a little something about it. It's very heavily driven by consultants. I think consultants do an excellent job of putting together charts that I'm not able to do. So this is the way in which they're looking at the world. And it's not that different from a COSO approach. The guy who runs this likes COSO very much, and he and I have had conversations about his like and my dislike for it. But the notion is here that this is sort of a circle. It's a flow. It's a flow of information where culture is enhanced, stakeholder value is enhanced. It's a principled approach to performance. So it's not just financial performance. It's where you are in the world. How do you treat your customers? How do you treat the people who work for you? And the second line here, applying tried and true business performance enhancement techniques to non-traditional activities. What he's saying in that statement, that's just a single bullet point way down in their documents. But what he's saying in that bullet point is that things like risk management and compliance and accounting really haven't had the same kind of regimens put to them that the production line has. So it's applying these things and making sure that there's quality control and risk management and audit and the likes. Again, this is a circular flow. So we have, what do we have so far? We've got a dashboard, a cube, and a circle. Just remember those. And then this is the SOX approach, and I'm not going to talk much about that, but I figure the best way to describe SOX is a smiling hammer, because that's about the way that I think people view it. One I like even more in terms of an approach to enterprise risk management is the Australia-New Zealand standard, 4360. If you go dig out on Google, you can find it for free. Somebody's posted it up there. But you can also buy it from this this standards group. It's not a very expensive document, and it's very short. It's about 30 pages long. But if you search under ANS/NZS 4360, you can find it. This is a principle-based approach. I don't know how familiar you are with the way in which the Australians approach governance, but I think when you try to find, even though they've had some really interesting problems down there, like National Australia Bank, I think the approach that Australians take to governance and risk management is probably among the best in the world. So I highly recommend that you take a look at this. And particularly the second point in here, again, this is just something I pulled out of their document, but the major risk for most organizations is that they fail to achieve their objectives. That's getting to the heart of it. That's getting to the heart of us saying this is about running a business better. So this isn't necessarily tick box, although there's several things in here that you might look at and say we have one of those or we're taking this approach, but that's not its intent. It wants you to understand losses and gains as well. We talk about risk quite often, we talk about loss. But risk is really about things that are different. Risk is what's different about the state of the world tomorrow than today. What you own may be worth more, it may be worth less, if we're putting it in financial terms. But that's what risk is. And risk management, then, is just about trying to shape that to be something we like. I don't know what to call this, but this is kind of a grid, kind of a flow, kind of a... This doesn't look like it was done by consultants because it's in black and white, and it's not that pretty. But if you go through this, it's the same. It's very similar to what you see in the GRC OSEG approach to this. And again, I would highly encourage you to read this. again, to give a chance to compare and contrast different approaches to enterprise risk management. This standard, interestingly enough, is not written just for financial companies. So you'll find companies that are in chemicals or government organizations that are dealing with things like biohazards or pandemics adopting this approach to risk management within their effort. So fair enough, enterprise risk management's been around for 14, 15 years now. Have there been some good critiques? Well, as I said, what do we have? We've got a dashboard, a cube, a hammer, a circle. Which one do you want to choose? There are a few different approaches to it. But an interesting critique that was published by the American Enterprise Institute less than a year ago, David Martin and I think it's Michael Power is his name. Has anyone heard of the book, The Risk Management of Everything? Have you seen that? I think this is the same author of that book. David Martin is the chief risk officer of Alliance Capital in New York, and then used to be chief risk officer of Citigroup. Back a few iterations of chief risk officers, must be four iterations now, of chief risk officers at Citigroup. But their critique of ERM is kind of going back to where James Lamb started this and saying, what is this dashboard that we expect to have? Do we envision people sitting in a room, tuning knobs and saying, no, flow the risk a little bit better to this part of the company, take a little bit back here, give me this great report that helps me to dissect everything going on in the company? And the notion is here that we really don't have that ability. I mean, we have greater computing power, we have better answers than we had a while back, but the notion that we're somehow controlling risk in such a fine-tuned way really sets us up for a great deal of criticism and probably for a good deal of failure. They take a similar approach to what you started to see in the Australia-New Zealand standard, in that their interest in enterprise risk management is to make it more of a business partner. There's an article I wrote for another risk management association back before when ours existed called Business Line Advocacy and the Role of the Risk Manager. And it's the same mindset, is that a risk manager really is working to help the business, to be an advocate for what the business is trying to do, rather than a control entity. If you haven't read the book, The Dark Side of Risk Management, I highly recommend that to you as well. Luca Celade is the chief risk officer of a hedge fund in London. He's one of the first people trying to bring in some of the elements of behavioral finance and psychology into risk management. And one of the things that Luca talks about, and I think it's similar to what Martin and Power are saying, is that we've created this illusion that we can, and this is his word, vivisect risk. And we can cut it apart into so many different pieces and allocate it out in so many different places that we have it fully under control. And yet, risk is still this thing that's very difficult for us to manage. So he's also warning us about being set up for failure. And as I mentioned just a second ago, Citigroup now is on their third chief risk officer in the last year. One, two retired. Morgan Stanley's chief risk officer retired. I don't think UBS gave their chief risk officer the dignity of retirement. I believe that person was let go. But what we've seen is that losses were realized, in some cases big losses, but losses were realized, and so we've fired the chief risk officer. That's a problem. Why does the chief risk officer get fired because there were losses? Aren't there losses every day in a business, and aren't some of those losses large? Maybe it is that these people have been set up in a way to believe that risk was so under control by having a chief risk officer and an enterprise risk management structure that 10, 15, 20, $100 billion losses, no, maybe no one's lost 100 yet, but 10, 20, 30, $40 billion losses couldn't happen, that Bear Stearns couldn't go away. Chief risk officer there is probably going to be looking for work. This is new. And on top of this, the extent that we try to create a very complex reporting structure, dashboards, cubes, different departments, whatever it might be, we face a challenge, and that's our ability to pay attention. Now, I'm going to take a little break from my presentation here, and I'm going to try and run a video. We had a little trouble getting this to work quite right before, so I'm hoping it's going to work. This is really a challenge to see how well you can pay attention to something. Okay, this is, you know, we're asked to look at a lot of different things. So there's a video that's going to be shown. There are going to be two teams, one wearing all white, one wearing all black. I want you to concentrate on the team wearing white. Both teams have basketballs. They're going to be passing basketballs to each other. and I want you to count the number of times that the team wearing all white passes the basketball to each other. Okay? Simple task. A little bit of complication to it. If they bounce pass it, don't count it. Does everybody know what a bounce pass is? So chest pass straight to the person, bounce pass goes off the floor. I don't know if everyone plays basketball here or not. So again, follow the white team, count the number of times that they pass it to each other. Don't count it if it's a bounce pass. Uh-oh. No, I don't want to. Okay. This is looking hopeful. Okay, everybody, watch the white team and count the number of times they've passed. Okay, pretty easy. Pretty easy task. Let me get my thing back up here. See if I can get this right. Okay. Anybody have an answer for me? How many times you counted? 12, 13, 14? So 12 to 15, 11 to 15 is the range that we're in. Okay, oh, you know what? I need to actually go back here. Excuse me. Somebody, I think, out there either noticed something in this or has seen this before. And the reason is that there's something you may not have seen. Did anyone see anything unusual? Okay, I've got four or five people who saw something unusual. So don't tell me yet what it is. The rest of you didn't see anything unusual when you were watching this? Okay, so maybe 50 people in the room, 7, 8 people saw something unusual. Don't count anything this time. Just watch the video, and you'll see something interesting happen in the middle here. Yeah, so one of the interesting things about our mind's ability to process data is that when we're given a task, even as simple as it might be, our mind can sometimes be fooled into thinking that it's seeing all it needs to see. And yet, in the proverbial sense, you miss the 500-pound gorilla in the room. I love that slide. I love that video. Because it's a way to bring some humility to us and recognize that the way in which we work as people isn't necessarily exactly what we think. It isn't something we're always aware of. So, are we really setting ourselves up sometimes with too much complexity around what we're putting forward as risk managers? So let me get back now to this concept of persistence and ductility and the valuation of an asset. The idea of persistence and ductility, I don't know if anyone familiar with this term ductility or ductile. It's actually a metallurgical process, I mentioned in the third bullet point here, but it's the ability for steel or other metal to bend without breaking. So it's a stress, it's a measure of the ability of metal to take on stress. In the corporate sense, it's really about a company that's able to take on stresses and not break, so it doesn't become brittle. The idea of ductility and persistence, then, is that we want to create a longer stream of cash flows. If the notion is that our company is generating positive cash flows, profits, whatever, to a point that we have some market value, to the extent that we can make the horizon over which those cash flows are being discounted longer, maybe small amounts, but we should increase the value, all else equal, of the organization that we have. Now, the process of annealing, I hope I've spelled that correctly, is the process of things heating up, of metal heating up and being reshaped. And I love this term because this term is used in a couple of other areas about how to reshape things. So the notion of ductility and persistence goes beyond just trying to extend the length over which cash flows are discounted, but how a company is shaped by the heat it's under, by the stresses that it faces. Certainly the markets are in an annealing time, or banking sectors in an annealing time. It's being reshaped. It's being reshaped with money coming in from sovereign funds. It's being reshaped by firms disappearing, by the structure in which organizations find themselves, decisions are making about their structure at this point. And we don't yet know what it's going to be like. But if our markets really are good and our risk management's good and this notion of derivatives and this distribution of risk is good, this process of annealing is healthy. It's just changing the way in which things work and the way in which they look. If you've heard me speak before, there's a 90% chance you've seen this silly slide. This is a very simplistic slide, and I apologize. It's not quite as simplistic as a smiling hammer, but it's pretty close to that. This is an attempt to illustrate problems. So I talk about risks being positive and risks being negative, but this focuses on the negative aspects of risk. And the notion here is that problems take time to reach their full potential. So this scale on the left is 0 to minus 100%. What that means is when it reaches this point, it's reached its full potential impact as a problem. Doesn't mean it's $100 million. It could be $100. It could be $100 billion. But it's reached its full impact. Some events happen more quickly. Some take longer periods of time. And in a brittle system, some of these are going to break the company. So the metal snaps. The company snaps. Bear Stearns snapped. LTCM snapped. A number of companies have snapped because they've reached a point of brittleness. Now, in a ductile system, things are in place. Things, I use that very generically. They're in place that interrupt these problems as they're trying to reach their potential. So this could be risk awareness, could be somebody who uses a hotline, an escalation policy, something to stop a problem from reaching its full potential. Again, this might be, at this point, a $60 billion loss as opposed to a $100 billion loss, but the notion is that it's just stopped it from getting as far as it could. In enterprise risk management, what are some of the points of brittleness that we should probably be thinking about? Well, I mentioned firm value. Obviously, we care about what investors think of our company. We care about what regulators think, because a regulator can come in and shut you down. Or, perhaps even more importantly, a regulator can come in and burden you with a tremendous amount of work to become compliant with what they have asked you to do because they sense that there's some problem. Not a lot of us in risk talk about customers. Had an interesting conversation with Deepak Jain, who's the dean of Kellogg Business School at Northwestern, asked me one time how many chief risk officers I know have responsibility for the customer. Getting back to that comment in, or that bullet point, I think it was in the ANS standard, about not being able to reach your objectives, or maybe that was the OSEG standard, not being able to reach your objectives. If you misunderstand where your customer's going, that's probably one of the biggest risks you face as a company. Liquidity providers, again, if they turn on you, as they did in Bear Stearns, I don't know if anybody's getting this strange sense about all the headlines about Goldman Sachs in these last few days, too. It almost feels like there's a little piling on going on Goldman. I don't think anything's going to happen with that. But there have been interesting headlines being thrown out. Like today, Goldman lost more money on more days than any of its peers in the last quarter. And Goldman's Level 3 assets, the ones that are very hard to value, have increased more than any of their peers. So the strange headlines that feel a bit like piling on, like they did with Bear Stearns. But if your liquidity providers turn on you, or in Bear Stearns' case also their customers turned on them, you can snap. And your suppliers, with just-in-time inventory management, just-in-time parts management, continued just-in-time delivery, continues to become more and more the standard. You have substantial risk to your suppliers, and a supplier perhaps providing you with faulty or poisonous materials for your products turns your company into something that your customers don't want to deal with anymore. Now, SARF, has anybody in this room ever heard of SARF? Okay, good. So I get to explain something new. SARF stands for the Social Amplification of Risk Framework. Now, when I use that slide to show problems getting to their point of impact, the SARF framework comes out of psychology and tries to describe when risk events take on a whole life of their own. So there's the initial impact of a risk event, and then the multiplying factors on top of that, which typically follow some sort of amplification process through people. So did you hear that Bear Stearns lost 10 of their biggest customers? Did you hear that Goldman Sachs? Did you hear that? That kind of amplification tends to work its way out. And they've done quite a bit of study in non-financial risks to show that the impact of the amplification is typically many multiples of what the initial impact of the risk realized would have been. We can read this a little bit. I hope you guys can read that back there. The social amplification of risk framework tries to put things into quadrants. And this chart doesn't show the quadrants very well. But the quadrants are based on two factors, unknown risk and dread risk. Unknown risk is, to what extent do we understand this? To what extent do we understand the risk that is being realized? There's an earthquake. To what extent do we understand how earthquakes impact the building that I'm in? There's a subprime crisis. To what extent do we understand that the bank has exposure to subprime risk? And then dread, which is, can it be controlled? Is it global? Are the consequences fatal? Fatal can be to a person, to an entity, catastrophic, involuntary, risks increasing, etc. When you have a high level of dread and a high level of unknown risk, you're up in this quadrant here, those are the places where the social amplification of risk becomes even more magnified. So subprime crisis is a great example. It's perfect for being up in this quadrant over here. Some of the examples that they use, if I remember correctly, the people who've done this research, would be, you know, let's say, for example, a pandemic breaks out, and it's a disease no one ever knew about before. SARS maybe is something like that. People think it might be fatal. They don't understand it. They don't trust the people who've been telling them about this stuff because they haven't been accurate, and they're not really sure. It's a new risk, and it's unknown to science. This makes it something that people respond to in very dramatic ways. But subprime, again, we don't really know what a lot of banks hold. We know more than we did 3 or 4 months ago, but when this all started last summer, we didn't really know who was holding what, how bad it was going to get. We thought it might be catastrophic. We thought it might be global. This is something to react to. And what was the main reaction that we saw? Liquidity providers pulling back and saying, I don't know what you have, but I don't want to be the last one holding what you have. And that's the main part of the subprime crisis, I think, that has been realized, and that the STAR framework helps to explain nicely. Why do we care about this? This pushes us towards brittleness. If you're aware of some of the things within your company that create brittleness, look at them in this context, and you might have a sense for how to deal with them. Can transparency help? Perhaps. Transparency, we hear people arguing about full transparency for companies. Transparency helps you in this unknown risk factor, but not necessarily in this dread factor. So it could help a little bit, but it may not be enough. All right, I'm going to try and move a little bit more quickly through this. The board is a point of brittleness. The board is the overall responsible entity for the company. They are the proxy of the shareholders. Shareholders can't control the company, so they have this board of directors in the U.S. model that's been elected, and the board has the responsibilities of a duty of care and a duty of loyalty. They're supposed to be loyal to the company, and they're supposed to care for it. They're supposed to care for the assets that I've pledged this. A board also sits in the highest level of authority within a company. In psychology, there's something called the authority influence. That's what a board of directors has. It's the ultimate authority influence within a company. And the board is responsible for governance. Now, here are a couple of great cases that governance hasn't worked so well. This Kidder one is an example, but it's not. I didn't mean to put it in that spot. But the ANZ Bank in Australia, cited by the regulator there in PricewaterhouseCoopers, the board being responsible for not having set the right culture. Barings. The board of Barings didn't discuss Nick Leeson's trading in the sense that you might think they did. They discussed it in how they might protect his market share. I don't know if you knew that or not, but one of the discussions they had as a board was, how do we keep other companies from doing what he's doing? Because he's doing it so well, and look at all this great customer business he's got for us. You know, customer business was fake, but that's the way in which they looked at it. So Premia has taken, a couple of years ago, a survey of governance documents. I mentioned those 4 or 5 ERM frameworks that are out there. There are probably 20 or 30 governance documents that you could print out and tell you what you should do, what makes good governance. So what Premia did was to take 8 or 10 of these and try and find some common principles among all of those. And these 7 principles are the ones that that have been found to be common across documents. You can download those from the website. Sufficient competencies. Do you have the right people in place? And a lot of this is at the board level, and we'll focus on in a second. Sufficient resources and process, key parties. You can read all this. And I'm going to touch on a couple of these now in a survey that I just finished with Michael Keener of Columbia Business School. We did a benchmarking study in January and February. We had 65 firms participate. These are top firms on Wall Street, top banks, international, domestic. A number of them were non-financial. As you can see from the profile, almost 80% are in the top quartile of their industry. 60% are the largest in their industry. Most of the people who participated in the survey were CROs, and the reason that is because we targeted them because they had CROs, so they were advanced entities in terms of risk management. And then we followed the online survey up with several one-on-one interviews, and we're very appreciative of how open people were with us about their risk management structure. We're asking, how does the board relate to the company? This authority influence that the board has over the enterprise risk management and governance, how does it relate? In this survey, 40%, roughly 35-40% report now directly to the board. This is a big change from just a couple of years ago. That may seem like a small number, but it's actually a very big change. Only 22% don't have some sort of board relationship. And on the boards now, many of these companies, 30% have a single person on the board responsible for risk management. That is an incredible responsibility for someone to take on. But if you go into Premia's governance principles, it's one of the things that Premia says should be part of your governance. There should be accountability at the board level, at least with one person or certainly with one committee. 90% of the companies we survey have a risk management policy. No surprise there. They have chief risk officers. Let's hope they have risk management policies. Interesting that 10% still do not. But then the question is, are these understood? Well, the board's engaged in this. That's good. They think generally, 3/4 of them think that their board has sufficient ability to understand the policies and the things that the company is doing. But there's a substantial percent are either neutral on this or don't think that their board has enough understanding and enough knowledge to be able to work responsibly on risk management. So who's taking a look at it? With the companies that came back to us, these are the board's committees that exist. Still about 90% of them have an audit committee, but only about 25% have a risk committee. So this audit committee has a tremendous amount of responsibility. And in fact, when we ask them which committee has the primary oversight, 1/3 of them still have that with the audit committee, only 17% with a risk committee. This audit committee's got accounting, external audit, all sorts of things reporting up to it, and they have a tremendous amount of things on their plate, in addition now to putting this complex risk structure in place. So the chief risk officer participates, advises them about 8 out of 10 times. That's encouraging. But what are they doing to help their boards advance? More than 1/3 said that they don't have any kind of risk education session for their board. This is the top of the house. This is the group responsible for the governance policy and really responsible for the enterprise risk management of the organization. And fully 1/3 of them don't have any kind of education program going on for their board. What about for all employees? Well, more than 1/3 disagree that they even train their employees in their risk policy. There's a big gap here. I mean, we're developing these policies from on high, but we're not bothering to teach people about it. And then what about changes in the policy? Again, 20% or so say that they're not even bothering to train people on how their policy is being changed. What if what you're doing isn't right? How do you check? Well, we ask them, do they use external consultants? More than half say no. Well, maybe that means consultants don't know what they're doing. But it's an interesting thing that they're not even asking outside of the company. Most of them rely on industry reports, internal audit, or this one, staggering to me. 54% of them rely on regulators. No knock on any regulators in this room. I think the Canadian regulators are amongst the best. I can say that because I do have to leave the country and get back in. I hope you'll let me out. But I do sincerely believe that. But the notion that regulators are a source of external benchmarking for more than half of these advanced companies. That was really shocking to me. And internal innovation and reporting, whatever that means, I've got a great idea, let's do it, I suppose is what that means. Okay, so a couple of the insights that come out of this survey. In our interviews with people, one of the key governance principles that we saw was that Premia has is that there has to be an independence. There has to be a way for information to reach the board. So how do you get that? If you have board direct reporting, you have some of that. But we found two people in our survey who have non-direct reporting to the board, but if there's any change in their compensation or any sort of punishment to them as employees or dismissal, the board has to approve it. So the CEO wants to fire the chief risk officer, the board has to agree to that. So it's a nice check and balance. There's a company in Australia that uses a well-designed survey embedded in which are assessments of risk culture. And managers within the company have their bonus somewhat determined by whether the risk culture scores in their departments meet the company standards. And if they don't, their bonuses can be impacted. The risk and audit committees, we found that audit and compensation committees have plenty of outside consultants. The risk committees don't necessarily have the expertise coming in because it's not out there. But the way in which people are approaching things is evolving rapidly. Okay, that's no shock. Getting back to the psychological notion of authority influence and the top of the house communicating whether risk management matters and whether governance matters. There's a paper from the mid-60s. I have not read the paper, but I read an interesting reference to it, in that this person was trying to map how well information is passed along. So I can't remember the name of the, there's some sort of a bit if I whispered something to you, by the time it got to the back of the room, it might be completely different from what I initially told you. So this person tried to model that and just said, look, you can't say everything in communicating it down. So the board says to the CEO, here's our risk tolerance. Says to the CRO, here's our risk tolerance. Here's our risk policy. The CRO says to the heads of risk management in different groups, here's our risk policy. Here's our corporate culture around risk. They then go down to their mid-level employees. Here's our corporate policy. Here's our risk. It gets down to the line employees, maybe about 6 or 7 levels down from the CEO. But if 15% of the true meaning is lost, and this gentleman apparently has some metric that gives him a sense that that's a fairly conservative number, then 4 levels down in the communication, half of the message has been lost already. So not only do we have a board at the top saying they're putting policies in place, maybe they don't understand them, but then by the time it's communicated down to the people who can do anything about it, the message has been garbled, or at least half of it has been lost. So this command and control approach to risk management, where it's coming from the top down, has all sorts of inherent risks in it. This one I may have to go over more quickly because this is a point of brittleness, but it's actually, I could spend a lot of time on it, and I want to get to the conclusion so that we have a little bit of time. And you're welcome to go to the website here, or I'll give you a card, whatever, and you can download a chapter that I wrote on aligning compensation systems with risk management objectives. There are ample cases out there where incentives to help people or incentives that try to drive behavior in corporations have led to major downfalls and major misalignments of the objectives. So I tell a salesperson, I want you to do this, but I pay you to do this. What are they going to do? They're going to do what you pay them to do. So recently, though, we saw that one of the Fed governors call for Wall Street to change the way in which it pays people, to align compensation with the risk that they're taking on. Why is it that somebody selling a credit-sensitive product is paid today when the credit risk extends over 3, 5, 10, 20-year horizon? How do you pay somebody that makes them feel like they have the same kind of exposure that the company does, if that's what you want? Swiss Re Board calling for the same thing. Now, in a misalignment, Dan has a copy of a paper, I think, maybe it's even on the Fed's website, that Till Sherman and another gentleman wrote about some of these incentive frictions that were in place in the subprime crisis, things that created the incentive for people to commit fraud. But now when we look at incentives and how we structure them, it's not such an easy case to just say, do it one way or do it another, because there's an entire spectrum of people within an organization. People who are very well advanced in their careers tend to become risk averse. I'm a senior executive. I own a lot of stock in the company. My career's looking pretty good. I can see another 10, 15 years of work here. I'm not really going to take a lot of chances. But that's not necessarily what you want in the company. So maybe you try to find ways to create risk-taking behavior in that organization. You have to do this in a way such that, again, what you're paying them to do, it aligns with what you're trying to get them to do in terms of risk-taking. And I'm sorry to jump over this part so quickly because I think it's really interesting. One quick note on another element of psychology, risk-sensitive foraging. Case of a salesperson. I tell a salesperson, you have to do $2 million in sales this year or you're fired. They know if they go to sell in this one place, they're sure to get $2 million in sales. They know if they go to this other place, they're going to get 1.8 or 2.2. They're going to go to the sure bet. Okay? No risk. No risk to them, no risk to us. They reach their $2 million objective. I changed that slightly to $2.1 million in sales. Now that salesperson has to take the risky option because if they go the safe route, they're sure to get fired. So this comes from literature in how animals feed. They have to find certain amounts of calories in order to be able to survive. But it applies as well in the settings that we create for paying people. All right, I'm going to jump over this because there are too many things to go in depth here. Sorry if I mentioned. Now, getting back to firm value. One of the things that behavioral finance has discovered and what psychology has shown us is that people don't like loss. They're loss averse. It's not risk averse, they're loss averse. So if I said to you, let's play a game, toss a coin, if it's heads, you pay me a dollar, if it's tails, I pay you a dollar. In these studies, most people don't want to play that game. Maybe it's just boring because it's 50% chance. But it turns out it actually takes about 3 times the payout on the upside to get people interested in playing this game, even though it's a fair game. Other studies, you have the ability to cure people who are sick, but if you take one route, 40% of the people who have the disease are going to die, with certainty. Present that in a different way, where the same number of people are expected to die, but you framed it in a positive way, 70 to 80% of the people will choose the one that's framed in a positive manner. So people, in the way in which they process data and process information, they don't like loss, and so they assign a greater value, greater negative value on loss, than they do on gains. And I'm going to get back to that in just a second. This is the area that I want to steer you to do more reading. There's a new area of science called complexity. Now, complicated systems and complex systems are a little bit different. A complicated system is something that, you know, it has lots of parts to it. A toaster, for example, is a complex or a complicated system. But a complicated system is one that you can break down and find all of its parts. And what the entity is just the sum of all of its parts. A complex system is one that somehow, through the interaction of all of its parts, creates something new. The human body is an example of a complex system. There are lots of different cells that if you took them apart and put them on a petri dish, they wouldn't do anything, necessarily. But coming together, they're this entity that lives and breathes and thinks and takes risks and does all sorts of interesting things. Ant farms, bird flocks, schools of fish, all behave as complex systems. They get into this, the literature gets into something called emergence theory. And emergence theory is how something emerges out of this integration of all these parts that, again, wasn't there just as you break down the parts. The reason this is interesting is because they start to talk about complex adaptive systems. These are systems that adapt to changes in their environment, may becoming stronger, but not breaking. This is just the same as the concept of ductility, of persistence. And the stuff that's being done in this area, there's a group called the Santa Fe Institute out in New Mexico that is doing absolutely fascinating, incredible research in this area. And I think that they are going to turn finance and economics on its head. Read this. There's a simple book out there called, relatively simple book, called Complex Adaptive Systems. And I would encourage everyone to take a look at that. Read through it. It's going to change the way in which you think about everything you see in the markets and everything you see in economics. So what does all of this stuff mean? Again, we're getting back to the value of the firm. If we think that loss is something that impacts us more than gain, the notion of the value of the firm today is going to be heavily dependent on the distribution of those future states of the world. And perhaps the way in which we're measuring it today, so that $100 down is the same as $100 up, or maybe even a slight, you know, we might have some sort of slight utility function adjustment to that. But if that's the way in which we're valuing the asset, like a company, we're probably missing something very big in terms of what's going to happen to the value of our firm when a tail or near tail event happens. Business activities can become impaired. What happens to this future value or this future stream of cash flows if your business activities get impaired? How can they be impaired? The rating agencies cut your ratings. They cut the ratings on a particular tranche of a security. Your liquidity providers go away. Your customers go away. Your regulators come in and start sitting on the house, or people start suing you. Large pension advisory firm is threatening to oppose directors and sue firms if they can't demonstrate that they've exercised good governance during the subprime crisis. This then all of a sudden reaches what many of you have seen in a book called The Tipping Point. The tipping point generally is expressed in a positive, when a new fad catches on, iPods, whatever it might be, but also in a negative sense, much like the social amplification of risk framework starts to look at how things take on a new life of their own. Remember in complexity theory and emergence, this is an emergence of something new, something that isn't there from its component parts. Why is it that $200 or $300 billion in subprime losses has led to multiple $1 trillion of loss in valuation? There's something more that's there beyond just that first level impact that we've got. Now, what does risk management do? This is all maybe sounding negative. But what risk management does, if we do it well, is it again teaches us how to appreciate the value of risk. What is the price of risk? If we start to look at it in this new framework, in this new mindset, that we're not really assigning the proper value to big losses in terms of valuing assets, there's a much greater value to implementing things that can stop problems from reaching their potential. Risk management becomes something that's very important to the organization. It becomes ingrained in the decision-making process that every manager is engaged in, whether it's dealing with a new customer, launching a new product, opening a new business line, or making an acquisition. Risk management just becomes part of the normal conversation. And by this, the risk manager acting as an educator, acting as an advocate, acting as someone who's trying to help the business grow responsively, frees the business to make risk decisions. We're not command and control from the top. We're not trying to say, stop, don't do this, you're outside of your policy. What we're trying to do is say, yes, do this, do it in an innovative way. Know that you've got the freedom to do this because we know you followed a good process. And that's a very positive way for risk management to work. So with that, we go to one last slide from our survey. We ask our CROs, why is it that you do enterprise risk management? And they tell us they do it for a lot of different reasons. The biggest reason is still control. Second biggest reason, loss avoidance. Maybe they're starting to sense something. And the third is competitive advantage. We start with this foundation of control, loss avoidance, understanding some of these tail exposures, and that helps us to become more strategic, more competitive, and better than those people that we're trying to compete against. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions. I know that jumped around a lot of different places and probably made some fairly broad assertions, but I think this is a really interesting thing going on in risk management right now. All those references I gave you, particularly the stuff around complex adaptive systems, I'd encourage you to take it home, try and do a little reading at night, as I think it'll challenge some of your current thinking. So thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions. Yeah.